Hi, welcome to this week's program. I have often spoken about the virtues of frugality, of living well below your means, and of saving and investing so compounding can grow your wealth, literally into a few million dollars, even on the most modest of salaries. It's not every day when you hear the words janitor, gas station attendant, and philanthropist describing the same man, but in one famous rags-to-riches story, Ronald Reed, a one-time janitor and gas station attendant from Vermont, amassed an $8 million fortune because of his frugal spending and smart investing habits. Reed drove a secondhand Toyota Yaris, which is a subcompact car that has a sticker price of $15,635 brand new. It delivers 30 miles per gallon in the city and 36 on the highway. Friends remember how he used safety pins to hold his coat together and cut his own firewood even in his 90s. Reed was also a good stock picker who held on to stocks for the long haul. When he died, Reed left $6 million to his local library and hospital, shocking everyone who knew him. Way to go, Reed. Now that's an inspiring story if anyone needs one. Reed's story truly inspires me to make every single one of my clients a Ronald Reed, but it also sort of frustrates me because most of us just aren't going to make those sacrifices every day for a much richer future. Now, Reed is not alone. Just Google the words frugal man donates millions, and you'll learn of Leonard Gagowski, a quiet and frugal man who left $13 million to his alma mater. Leo started his life as a cook in the Navy during World War II. Then he ran a corner grocery store, invested in a nightclub, a dance studio. He loved dancing, and also some residential properties. Then there's Raymond Suckling, a World War II veteran and mechanical engineer who accumulated millions and donated $37 million to the Pittsburgh Foundation. Charles Kaufman, another local engineer, donated $50 million to the foundation. Really rich people with modest means all through their lives, bound by their love of frugality, saving, and investing. I'll mention just one more. Jack McDonald, a frugal Seattle resident known to have holes in his clothes and coupons in his pockets, who left $188 million in his will to three Washington institutions. Now, I came across an MSN Money article that I also want to share with you. It talks about the frugal ways of the world's wealthiest men and highlights how they continue to pinch pennies despite their billions. As the article says, some of the world's richest people live well below their means, opting for lifestyles that are anything but high maintenance and extravagant. David Churton, someone you've likely never heard of, is a mega-rich Stanford University professor who made $3.9 billion from an early investment in Google, and he's known to take thriftiness to extremes. He still lives in the modest home he bought before his Google investment, drives a Honda, cuts his own hair, and regularly asks for doggy bags at upscale restaurants. His mantra is, "Never spend in a way that I can't explain to my parents without apology or embarrassment." Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook's founder, who is back in the news, is worth about $55 billion, but still sort of lives like a student. Zuckerberg relies on old t-shirts and hoodies. He gets around in a Honda Accord, which he calls safe and non-ostentatious. He even got married in his own backyard. Michael Bloomberg of Bloomberg News says, "Pay yourself a small salary and top it up with dividends to reduce your tax bill." Bloomberg paid himself between $5,000 and $20,000 annually and has just two pairs of work shoes, which he gets resold when they wear out. Charles Dawson, a billionaire British discount chain owner, has two frugal lessons for us. One, never miss a chance to increase your wealth, and two, never throw anything you can use away. John Caldwell, another Brit, says, "I don't need to spend money to bolster my own self-esteem." Now, this self-esteem comment is a big one, because let's face it, we all know a person who uses their money to puff up their image and their self-esteem. Financier T-Bone Pickens puts together a list of what he needs beforehand, leaves the credit cards at home, and only brings enough cash with him to pay for the items on the list. Now, I would differ with T-Bone Pickens and say, use your credit cards, get your mileage, or get your cash back, and then pay them off every single month. That's today's version of using cash wisely. And finally, there's the Warren Buffett we know and love who eschews the high life and is well aware that small sums can compound to large amounts. though I think he really gets carried away sometimes. In the documentary Becoming Warren Buffett, seen on HBO, the camera goes along with him on his daily breakfast excursion to McDonald's. He tells his wife Astrid how much exact change to put in the center cup holder of his car. It's either $2.61, $2.95, or $3.17. He says, "When I'm not feeling quite so prosperous, I might go with the 261. That's two sausage patties, and then I put them together and I pour myself a Coke. 317 is a bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit. But the market's down this morning, so I think I'll pass up the 317 and go with the 295. The 295 option is the sausage McMuffin with egg and cheese." I mean, really, you know, there's nothing wrong with this, but he is worth $81.5 billion. That seems pretty over the top to me. Well, I think you get the idea. My main point is this. While we can't all be billionaires, it's literally well within the reach of every American, even those in the lowest income group, to retire a millionaire, provided they keep their family size in check and have the will to make a few small sacrifices every day, save a lot, and wisely invest every penny for the long run. Hey folks, I want to talk to you about something real quick. I'm putting on a workshop and I'm titling it Everything You Need to Know to Become a Retirement Genius. Well, most of us are not geniuses for sure, but that doesn't mean we still can't get it right, right? Actually, we've just got to get it right. So here are some of the topics I'll be covering. There's no question that stock markets have become much more volatile this year. And if you're taking income from your portfolio, you need to be sure you're taking it from the right places. I'll show you how. Also, we've had a period of rising interest rates and the prospect for even further rate hikes this year. Is this a good thing or is it a bad thing for you going forward? I'll talk about this at length because it's one of the most important topics this year. And I'll be giving my fearless forecast for the rest of 2018 and a lot more. You'll also have a chance to ask me any questions on your mind because, as always, my mission is to educate and empower you to help you make the right choices in your life. So join me Tuesday, April 17th. That's Tuesday, April 17th at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel at 10 a.m. Once again, Tuesday, April 17th at 10 a.m. For reservations, sign up at our website. You know it. It's stevepomerantz.com. What else could it be? It's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Scam artists and frauds steal over $100 billion from Americans each year. And in the financial services industry alone, 52,000 advisors were disciplined for misconduct in 2016. That's 7% of the workforce. And once they're terminated, if terminated, 44% of them are back working at another financial firm within a year. So what's going on here, and what can the investor in need of a good advisor do to protect themselves? Well, Bill Francavilla joins me to answer this and other questions from his new book, The Madoffs Among Us, Combat the Scammers, Con Artists, and Thieves Who Are Plotting to Steal Your Money. Bill is a certified financial planner with more than 30 years in the financial services industry. Hey, Bill, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Steve. I'm pleased to be with you.
Yeah, you know, the title of your book really kind of speaks for itself, The Madoffs Among Us. We all know about Bernie Madoff and the scams that he pulled, but why in particular did you write this book?
Steve, I spent over 30 years in the financial services business, and I will attest to the fact that the overall majority, the overwhelming majority of financial advisors are really doing a great job. They have their clients' interests at heart and are taking care of their needs, but it's always those several people, those few people on the periphery that are concerning. And they do constitute a pretty strong percentage, as I indicated, 7%, in all probability have been up to some nasty stuff. Mm-hmm. And this book was written in an attempt to not only warn Americans that they better be careful, but also to inform them of some of the basic elements to financial planning whereby they might even be able to go it themselves.
Yeah, so let's get to that point. But first, you quoted a study from 2012, the Certified Financial Planners Board of Standards studied senior financial exploitation, and it said 74% of investors have purchased unsuitable products, 58% of advisors omitted important facts, 48% may have misrepresented an investment, 46% are guilty of negligence or lack of follow-up, which are sins. Some of them, they're kind of sins of omission, maybe sins of lack of knowledge and things like that. But the last one is the one that bothers you and me the most. 19% committed fraud with intent or lying. So how does one spot a fraud?
Those are alarming statistics. And when I first read them, I said, oh my goodness, can this be true? But as a result of that very comprehensive study, as you indicated, there are three items that I'd like to point to that I think are most helpful for investors and clients. And I cue from a gentleman named Simon Lovell. He was the ultimate con man of the 20th century. He conned everybody. He'd go into a bar and do card tricks just to capture a little extra cash. He went to jail. He came out and he made a very interesting statement, Steve. He said, I love it when people tell me they can't be conned because in my mind, they're halfway to being conned. Mm. So the first element of advice that I present to anyone who's willing to listen is look yourself in the mirror and admit that you can be conned. We all think we're pretty smart. I think I'm a pretty smart guy. I know you're a pretty smart guy, but guess what? We can be conned. And maybe even, like me, Steve, you have been conned. I've been conned. Okay, admit it.
Let me interrupt you 1 second because it's fascinating. I once interviewed a professor who was an expert in Ponzi schemes.
Mm.
So he could smell them a mile away, and yet he got caught up in Madoff.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, not surprising.
So even an expert, yeah, that was surprising. We had a good interview, I can tell you, on air. It's like, what? You did what? What happened to you? Are you sure?
Hey, I wrote a book on scams, and I've been scammed. It's funny.
Okay.
It's not funny. It's sad.
Yeah, well, it happens to all of us. So number one, be humble, stay humble, and admit it, you are susceptible to getting scammed. What else?
Number two, avoid making any decisions with emotion. If it sounds too good to be true, guess what? It probably is. You know, every several months when the Powerball lotto gets up to $500 million, what happens?
Yeah.
Everybody starts buying in and they exploit the whole situation and it swells even further than that $500 million. We typically are governed by greed and fear.
Yeah.
And if something sounds too good to be true, guess what? Why don't you take a break? Step back, maybe let it resonate for 24 or 48 hours.
Yeah.
And number three, the key variable, the key ingredient to making certain that we are not being conned is knowledge. It's information. You can easily do a Google search on something that sounds too good to be true, and it is going to uncover a plethora of information and experiences from other people who will tell you, stay away, this is not good. For instance, the IRS. This is a current, a very, very popular scam. And incidentally, Steve, in my book, you know, I talk about financial services because that's been my background. But during my research, I uncovered a number of other scams that are prevalent in American society today. So I mention those to make sure that people are aware of it.
Yeah.
The IRS scam is very simple. You get a robocall. This is Agent Bill Smith, and I'm calling to tell you that your taxes are very seriously delinquent, and unless you call this number back, we're going to dispatch the sheriff's department to arrest you.
Yeah.
Well, I got one of those calls, and I knew it was a scam. I called. I said, hey, tell me, what's going on? And they said, well, you owe us, I think it was $1,600, and unless you pay. I said, how do I pay? He says, well, give us your credit card number, and we will make this go away.
Love it.
Guess what? The IRS doesn't operate that way. Yeah. I've got my opinions, but they don't operate that way.
Well, first of all, the IRS is not going to call you. The IRS does not call you.
No.
You know, we just were subject to something like that because we have a Facebook page for the show, and we got blocked somehow. And we've been trying to get in touch with Facebook, and there was a number to call, and basically they said, yeah, well, you know, what you need to do is you need to go to Walgreens and get a gift card. And I mean, it was more detailed than that, but that was the bottom line. So,
but here's the sad part about it, Steve. I mean, you and I are chuckling over this, but it works.
Yeah, it must work.
People think, oh, that's all I have to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I know. It works.
Incidentally, the IRS scam, there was a guy from India who had a factory full of people making outgoing calls, scamming Americans on this IRS scam.
Mm-hmm.
$300 million they were able to capture in just a handful of months before he was arrested.
Oh, my
so,
gosh.
You know, as silly as it sounds, it's effective for these thieves.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talk about smart people or whatever, but it seems to me that all of us are busy doing other things. We really can't be expected to be experts in everything. And, you know, the financial services industry and investing, you know, contains a fair amount of complicated kinds of products and concepts that are intangible concepts. They're concepts of the mind. They're not physical concepts like going to buy a car and the like. And I want to get into that in a minute, but we're going to stop right now. We're going to be back with Bill Francavilla. The book is Madoff's Among Us, Combat the Scammers, Con Artists, and Thieves Who Are Plotting to Steal Your Money. We'll be right back. Hey, have you signed up for my Retirement Genius Workshop yet? For those of you who may have just tuned in, it's Tuesday, April 17th at 10 a.m. at the Renaissance Hotel in Boca Raton. That's Tuesday, April 17th at 10 a.m. For more details and to sign up now, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I'm back with Bill Francavilla. The book is Madoff's Among Us, Combat the Scammers, Con Artists, and Thieves Who Are Plotting to Steal Your Money. And if you want to hear the first part again, don't forget to go to our website at stevepomerantz.com, where you will be able to hear the first part of this. Bill, welcome back. I was talking about the idea that all of us are really busy doing other things, and investments or, you know, the practicing law. These are complicated things to a large degree. You know, you speak in your book about famous people like Billy Joel getting ripped off and Robert De Niro. Quickly tell us about those two.
Well, actually, what you just said bodes so true. We are busy and we all have our professions, and it does take a pretty good effort to fully comprehend and understand the nuances of financial planning and the financial markets and so on and so forth. Billy Joel, in his situation, he lost several million dollars to his brother-in-law, who simply said, I'm your financial guy. And Billy Joel said, great, and paid him a ton of money over a number of years in commissions and fees and so on and so forth. But he wasn't investing it on Billy Joel's behalf. He was ingratiating himself and spending it and had an opulent lifestyle.
Yeah.
And when it all came tumbling down, guess what? Billy Joel was out that money.
Yeah.
There was no recourse. It was all gone. But Billy Joel was doing what he does best. He was entertaining, and he was trusting somebody, and there was no accountability, no follow-up. You know what? I guess if Joel was guilty of any one thing, he should have been paying attention, because by not paying attention, he paid dearly. And De Niro, oh man, God love him. His dad was an artist, and he did several paintings, and Robert De Niro was very proud of his father's work, and his dad passed, and he would showcase them, and it was time to redeem these. He hired an art broker to come in and represent him. Well, he did represent De Niro, but he mostly represented himself, and he simply took the money, and De Niro lost about $1 million.
Yeah. Well, I think with the Billy Joel example, first of all, it was a relative and an uncle, I guess, or something. And
yes, that's right.
You trust him and he's part of the family and he's kissing your babies and he's fussing over it and all that. And so you don't really think of that. But I think one of the ways, because, I don't think Billy Joel is going to become an expert in investments, but it would be nice to have checks and balances, also have an accountant, have an attorney, have the three of them, separate, not in the same office or whatever, working together, but, kind of looking over each other's work and making sure that, checks are going into the right accounts and made out to the right entities and things like that. Also, you mentioned one other thing, and I don't know if this applies strictly to Billy Joel, but you said, the uncle was earning commissions and things like that. Well, it seems to me that, you really don't want to have an advisor that's also advising you and then also earning commissions on the things that you're being sold. I mean, brokers that do that and they do fine. But, really, if you think about it, it's a conflict of interest and you really don't know whose interest is being best served when it comes to a commissionable item. So I think arm's length is the best course of action there. So, Bill, doesn't the financial services industry police their advisors?
They do. And got to tell you, they've done a pretty darn good job. FINRA, Financial Regulatory Authority, as well as the Securities and Exchange Commission, as well as the respective state departments that oversee a lot of these situations, they have been very, very compelling with the firms, making certain that they are looking out after their respective clients' best interests, monitoring the activities, the trades of their financial advisors. But you just can't do it. You just can't cover all your bases. There will be some miscreant. Mm-hmm. There will be some bad person in a corner office somewhere who is getting away with the figures that you had stated earlier in our call. The 19% who, with intent, will perhaps lie or defraud the investor. Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren from Massachusetts, she has introduced some legislation that could be far-ranging. But I got to tell you, more than anything else, it's a boon for the attorneys because it's going to kick up a tremendous amount of litigation.
You're talking about this law that Warren is talking about. That's what you're talking about?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. She is going to make the respective firms liable in the event someone steals, say they steal $100,000 from someone and there is no financial recourse for the plaintiff, the firm has to come back and make that person whole.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to get any legs. I really don't. It's kind of like trying to legislate morality.
Yeah. So, you're going to have the rotten apples and I don't want to get into the politics of it. It's not that important to this discussion. So let's get to the areas that our listeners can really benefit from. First of all, let's talk about what the book is. It's The Madoffs Among Us, Combat the Scammers, Con Artists, and Thieves Who Are Plotting to Steal Your Money. So let's learn how to do that. So you list in your book three types of financial advisors to avoid. Who are they?
Yes. Number one, it's the novice. It's the person who just certified for his or her Series 7, who has little or no experience in the industry and really helping people solve their problems. Now, Steve, I was that person.
Yeah, we all
I
were,
was a
right?
novice. Everyone gets started, right?
Yep.
And the exception to that is if that younger person in the business has a mentor or perhaps works on a team, mm-hmm. can bounce solid ideas from a senior person mm-hmm. to really, really supplement the decision-making that is so important to the client. But, oh my goodness, I remember my first year in the business.
Terrible.
I was dangerous.
Stupid.
I was
dangerous.
I tried to do the right thing, right?
Yeah.
I just didn't have the information. I'm sorry. The learning curve is pretty steep.
Yeah, that reminds me of, you know, someone's nephew who just got into the business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, so you may throw them some business, throw them some money, you know, as just kind of a gesture. Mm-hmm. But really, first of all, you really don't want to do, you know, business necessarily with someone in the family unless they're very well trained and also have a lot of experience and, you know, you can go through all that. But, you know, I see this from time to time. I've been in practice for over 35 years and, you know, nephew will get into the business. So they throw in some money. So the novice is a big deal. Novices are, by definition, dangerous. I would agree. I was dangerous. You've admitted you were dangerous. We both know what we're talking about.
You bet.
What's the second type to avoid?
The second person is the person who is highly opinionated. Someone who believes that the markets are going to grow to the clouds and you've got to be 100% invested and don't worry about it. You can make a ton of money by being 80, 90, 100% invested in equities. Mm. Conversely, it's the person who says, oh my goodness, the sky is falling. Let's move to cash. Let's move to precious metals. Let's move to guaranteed annuities because there's no future in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're entitled to their opinions, and one of them is going to be right. But the business of investing, the business of financial planning is to meet the individual's needs. We don't have to listen to the extremes. We just want to focus on perhaps our number one goal is a comfortable retirement, and we're in our early 50s, mid-50s. There's a plan for that.
Mm-hmm.
Forget about the noise. Forget about the highly opinionated, because you're going to be disappointed.
Especially if we know that we're driven by greed and fear.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's saying that the market's going to crash, go to gold, go to this, I'm afraid of that, you know, and all that. That's bubbling up. That gets to bubble up the fear inside you. And, you know, they know that. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to get you to act. What's the third one?
The third one is the salesperson. The person who invites you to a nice luncheon or a nice dinner and has one product that is going to solve all of your financial needs. It might be a variable annuity, an index annuity.
It's always an annuity of some kind. Yeah.
It's typically an annuity.
Yeah.
You know, I'm okay with annuities. Mm. They have a place. Mm-hmm. Absolutely have a place. But, oh, man. And you can see this person coming a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
They're slick. And they don't listen to what your problem is. They're not trying to solve your problem. They're trying to sell you something.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Again, we want to take a break, 24, 48 hours, do some homework, do a Google search of what this person is talking about, mm-hmm. who this person is. Make sure you're working with the right person with the right set of talents and understanding of markets.
Well, we're out of time, but I will add one further thing to that. You know, working with someone who only has one kind of product for sale, because there is this old saying that if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So it's a solution looking for a problem, you know, instead of a problem looking for a solution. My guest is Bill Francavilla, and the book is The Madoffs Among Us, Combating the Scammers, the Con Artists, and Thieves Who Are Plotting to Steal Your Money. And I definitely recommend this book. It teaches us the kinds of certifications you should look for in an advisor, the things that you need to teach yourself before you start to get into the world of investments. You don't have to be an expert, but you do have to have some basic knowledge and, you know, make sure that if you don't, you're with an advisor that is happy to educate you as well. Bill, thank you so much for joining us. We'll have you back, promise.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I look forward to it, Steve.
Good luck with the book. Take care.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
To hear this show again and to listen to the full show, get the summary of the final info discussed here today, don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update where we'll send you the weekly commentaries and our interviews straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So here's the question. I get asked this question a lot as a financial advisor. Are ultra-low mortgage rates gone forever? What do you think?
Gosh, the million-dollar question. I got to tell you, in my lifetime, this is the lowest that I've ever seen. I don't know that it can go any lower. Mm-hmm. I know that everything has a time and a place. And, you know, from what I can see, the economy is doing well. The rates are only going to rise. Keep in mind, too, that the rates were artificially suppressed in order to pull us out of the housing crisis.
Right.
And, you know, we're in a very much a seller's market. So honestly, I think it's time for, you know, the party to end on the interest rates. I mean, obviously, I love seeing the low interest rates, mm-hmm. but I know that it's not going to last forever.
Well, you have to remember that economies are cyclical. So we had a booming economy in the 2000s, and a lot of that was fueled by easy credit and housing prices rising and people pulling money out of their houses with home equity lines of credit. Big mortgages, multiple houses, a lot of that craziness happened. And then it all collapsed and the new cycle started. So what happened was the economy really fell into a funk and the Fed had to significantly lower interest rates in order just to keep the patient alive, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the patient is out of ER, out of emergency and critical care. And the patient's walking around. The patient's actually running 5Ks now. We're talking about the economy. Things are good. Well, guess what? The cycle is starting to turn. It's time for interest rates to rise again. So as a borrower or as an investor, you want to be prepared for that. You want to understand where you are in the cycle. Now, we don't know when. We don't know by how much. Forecasting interest rates are pretty much impossible. But I think their handwriting is on the wall. You have anything to add to that?
Yeah, well, I have a millennial daughter who just recently graduated college just 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and she thinks this is an excellent time for her mom and dad to buy an investment property. Now,
okay.
I don't know who she thinks the beneficiary is going to be for this, but I think it's her.
Yeah.
So she sends me a property that she's interested in. It's a $600,000 house.
How old is she?
She's 24.
Okay.
So, you know, she wants me to take advantage of the market before it gets worse and buy this $600,000 property so that she could live in it and manage the property for me.
Ah, I love that.
So what I find very interesting in all this is, and she's young, but they have no idea what a mortgage payment even looks like, let alone understand the concept of, you know, the interest rates are rising. I mean, she hears like, oh, the market is good. You better jump on it before it's too late. But, you know, you don't start off in life with a $600,000 home, at least not in my household.
Yeah, well, you know, it has to do with how much she's making and all of that. But the first thing that she needs to do, and you've got to, you know, I'm sure you told her what to do. In my mind, this is a huge teachable moment.
Absolutely.
And it's like, hey, let's go online and see. Let's go to a mortgage calculator together. We will see.
Exactly.
Well, first of all, you know, someone's going to have to come up with 20%. So, you know, now you're at putting $120,000 down and you're borrowing the difference, the 80%, and now you're doing it at 4.5%. Gee.
Well, she about fell off the chair when I told her, she's looking at a $600,000. She goes, how much money do I need to put down?
Yeah.
I said, well, based on your income, $500,000. Well, I'm never going to have $500,000. I said, you better start saving.
Well,
I don't know what to tell you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you better rent. I think that's the...
Look at a $200,000 property.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's move on here. So you are showing properties every single day and you're showing kitchens. And we've got a survey here that discusses what the most valuable feature of a kitchen is these days. And I was surprised. Why don't you tell us what you found?
Yeah, the number one thing right now by 63% is more storage and organization. So when I say organization, we're talking about the deep drawers and the pullouts and the revolving corner trays and shelves, that sort of thing, the cookie sheet tray organizers.
I have a question about that, though.
Go ahead.
Does anybody cook anymore?
Exactly.
You know, where are you putting, what stuff do you have that you need to put in all these drawers?
Your stuff from your wedding 35 years ago.
Okay.
But Steve, do you know what the major features, what's the big countertops?
No. No clue.
Well, right now it's engineered quartz. You know, it used to be, you know, in all our MLSs, we'd describe the house granite countertops.
Yeah.
Like we were adding $100,000 in value by writing, house has granite countertops. But now engineered quartz has become more popular and is taking over the granite.
I don't know. It's such a terrible name. You know, couldn't they come up with something a little bit more fun except engineered quartz?
I still like the granite, to be honest.
What about flooring?
Flooring. Hardwood floors seems to be the number one. But when we talk in Florida, what we're seeing more so is the tile that looks like wood.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that.
I have
but that,
seen
that's
that.
That's really popular in Florida.
Yeah.
Wood in Florida sometimes isn't necessarily the best.
No. I mean, really, you've got moisture and issues. And this tile looks pretty amazing. I considered it when I redid my bathroom.
Yeah. So number one is natural wood. And then what's really declining is floors like the engineered wood and laminate. But here in Florida, we only have, for the most part, that engineered wood. So this is a national survey.
Mm-hmm. What about color? What is the color? What is the main color theme these days?
White. White, 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 white. And, you know, it was funny. Years ago, everybody wanted to get rid of, a white kitchen. And they wanted that dark wood. Now the dark wood's out and everybody wants the white kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, and you can't chase this stuff. I mean, you can't change your house style every 10 to 12 years.
No. Well, I guess just buy what you really like and then have an eye towards what the marketplace likes. But you know that styles are going to change. You know, just walk into an old house that has the orange carpets and the
shag carpet.
I'm thinking about the appliances. What were they called? Avocado.
Chocolate brown.
Yeah.
Remember those chocolate brown appliances?
I do. I'm glad I never see those again. Yeah, I don't see those anymore. My guest, as always, is Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Hey, have you signed up for my Retirement Genius Workshop yet? For those of you who may have just tuned in, it's Tuesday, April 17th at 10 a.m. at the Renaissance Hotel in Boca Raton. That's Tuesday, April 17th at 10 a.m. For more details and to sign up now, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. My guest is David Payne. He's both staff economist and reporter for the Kiplinger Letter. He was a senior principal economist at IHS Global Insight and an economist in the chief economist's office of the U.S. Department of Commerce. He's a certified business economist. And I'll tell you why I'm telling you his complete bio, because he's joining me today because I've asked him to talk to us and to help us understand this idea about what's going on with the tariffs. Now, don't change the dial. Tariffs are going to affect us all, and we need to know how and how this is all going to shake up. So, David, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, tariffs sound pretty abstract, but they're not, right? They're going to pretty much touch every American, especially, you know, with this idea that now President Trump has signed recently to put tariffs on steel and aluminum. Take us through that a little bit.
That's right. President Trump has been concerned about the impacts of imports on American industry. And so he's put tariffs on foreign steel, foreign aluminum, Canadian lumber, Canadian newsprint, and on washing machines and solar panels.
Mm-hmm. How does this differ from the kind of tariffs that we've had in the past? Because tariffs are nothing new.
That's correct. Generally, we have avoided tariffs. The last time we have had a significant tariff program was in 2002 and 2003, when President Bush put tariffs on steel as well. And that has had an impact on, or had at that time an impact on users of steel, although it did prevent the decline of steel jobs for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting outcome. So there's two players here. There's the producers of steel, which I guess would benefit, and then the users of steel, which are going to experience higher costs. So to what degree are the producers of steel going to benefit with regards to jobs and higher profits?
Yes, producers of steel, they have said that they will benefit. They've already started opening up some plants that have been closed. I believe U.S. Steel opened up a previously closed plant and hired 500 employees. There's an aluminum producer that in the U.S. that has expanded a plant, hiring 300 employees. So overall, I expect that the steel and aluminum industry in the U.S. will probably add about 10,000 employees because of the tariffs. And also U.S. lumber mills will probably hire about another 1,000 employees because of the Canadian lumber tariffs.
So about 11,000 all told. With regards to steel and aluminum, where are these plants mostly located?
Mostly in the Midwest, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana. So that's the primary areas that will benefit.
Okay. So let's take a look at the other side of the coin. The users, that would be kind of the rest of us who buy cars and appliances. What do you think the effect of higher steel and aluminum prices are going to be on the consumer?
Well, I think we won't see large effects, but we will see some small effects over a wide range of products. So, for example, the price of cars will probably go up about $200 to $300. The price of houses will rise about $5,000 for new construction. And most of that is lumber, but there's also a steel element to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
The impact on washing machines should be fairly significant, as well as on solar panels. So these are all things that we run across, you know, every day. And we may not notice the fact that the prices are going up on some of these items, but they will affect most of us.
Well, you're an economist. Do you think that the rise in prices will show up in the inflation numbers?
I don't think it will be a bump that people will be able to point to. So much so, it's probably going to fly under the radar. But it will have a marginal impact and will provide an extra padding on inflation.
You know, I can see the items that we've talked about. You know, it's pretty obvious there's a direct line between steel and lumber, between those and houses and cars and so on. But what other industries and purchases, let's say, that we're all going to end up making are going to end up costing us more due to the ripple effects of these higher prices?
There are other industries that are also affected that we may not really recognize. For example, you know, plane construction uses a lot of metal, of course. The defense industry uses a lot of metals. A lot of these things, you know, don't show up in the consumer price index, but they will have, you know, a small effect in the economy at large.
You know, President Trump made the point of emphasizing that tariffs would benefit these steel workers during the ceremony when he was signing, and he said he called a steel and aluminum production the bedrock and backbone industries of this country. Is steel and aluminum production the bedrock and backbone of our country?
Well, steel and aluminum production have had a long history in the United States and helped to jumpstart the American economy. But they're not so much, I'd say, a bedrock anymore, in the sense of our economy has shifted over to importing much of our raw materials and items that we need to produce with, and then using that material to make products for both the American market and as well as exports.
So it seems in my mind that other industries are more important, especially in the technology area.
That's right.
Yeah. How does the technology area compare to in size and importance to the steel and aluminum area?
Well, there's many more people employed in the technology field in the United States today than in basic products. And that's what's happening to the American economy, is that we're shifting to a service economy as well as to a more high technology economy. And that's a comparative advantage of the United States, mm-hmm. is that we specialize in high tech and services. And those things are what are primarily driving our economy at this point.
Yeah. So do you think, is this a backwards look at a 1950s, 60s economy and trying to somehow resuscitate something that, you know, really has less impact than it used to, in your opinion?
I think to a certain degree that's true. I'm not saying that, you know, we should ignore anything that any foreign producer does, because in some cases, you know, trade protection is needed.
Okay.
But I think we tend to be a bit short-sighted when we focus purely on basic industry and not on the entire economy. So, for example, it's often the case that tariff protection, while it saves jobs, and I've already talked about, you know, the fact that it will add jobs in steel and aluminum and sawmill industry, it will likely cost more American jobs than it creates. And that happens in three ways. First of all, companies that use the basic materials in the United States for their own production have a greater incentive to source from overseas or to move themselves out of the country entirely. I'm thinking specifically of the metal stampings industry for, you know, that provides or supplies the American auto industry. Also, there's potential retaliation from foreign producers or foreign countries. And they tend to pick products that have political significance in the United States.
Yeah.
So, for example, they might, you know, put tariffs on Florida oranges just because Florida is a political swing state,
mm-hmm.
or Kentucky bourbon because Mitch McConnell is from Kentucky, or Wisconsin cranberries because Paul Ryan is from Wisconsin.
Yeah. Once you get politics involved, then it gets very, very messy, and the whole idea and the message can be lost. But you're saying basically that the users who are going to experience these higher costs may move abroad so they can continue to access cheaper materials. Yeah, but if they are then shipping back to the United States, they're going to be subject to tariffs, aren't they?
Not in the form of finished products. So, for example, if you're supplying the auto industry with stampings, for example, there is no tariff on the stampings themselves. There's only a tariff on the basic metal.
Oh, okay. All right. So as you go up the line of production, there are no tariffs. So there's a lot of ways. So in your opinion, the positive effects may be somewhat localized, as you mentioned, the Midwest and other places, but some of the larger unexpected effects, they could affect the whole country possibly more negatively.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. My guest, David Payne, is both staff economist and reporter for the Kiplinger Letter, senior principal economist at IHS Global Insight as well. David, thanks for trying to make this a little bit clearer for us. We really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
To hear this again and listen to the full show, get a full summary of all the vital lessons that we learned here today, don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com and sign up for our weekly update, where we will send you everything that we've talked about here in audio form, transcript form, and summarized form for your convenience, so you can read it on the weekend. Thanks for joining us. Hey folks, I want to talk to you about something real quick. I'm putting on a workshop and I'm titling it Everything You Need to Know to Become a Retirement Genius. Well, most of us are not geniuses for sure, but that doesn't mean we still can't get it right, right? Actually, we've just got to get it right. So here are some of the topics I'll be covering. There's no question that stock markets have become much more volatile this year. And if you're taking income from your portfolio, you need to be sure you're taking it from the right places. I'll show you how. Also, we've had a period of rising interest rates and the prospect for even further rate hikes this year. Is this a good thing or is it a bad thing for you going forward? I'll talk about this at length because it's one of the most important topics this year. And I'll be giving my fearless forecast for the rest of 2018 and a lot more. You'll also have a chance to ask me any questions on your mind, because as always, my mission is to educate and empower you to help you make the right choices in your life. So join me Tuesday, April 17th. That's Tuesday, April 17th at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel at 10 a.m. Once again, Tuesday, April 17th at 10 a.m. For reservations, sign up at our website. You know it. It's stevepomerantz.com. What else could it be? It's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I know we all take our marriage vows very seriously and plan on spending the rest of our lives with the one we marry, but marriage is tough even in the best of cases, and oftentimes people's personalities, unwillingness or inability to compromise, and external factors come in the way of a happy married life and leave us with no sane option but to go through a divorce. In addition to the mental anguish of a divorce, there is, alas, the added pain of financial distress in many cases. So today, I plan to talk about avoiding three expensive divorce mistakes that could destroy your finances. And this was from an article by Catherine Tuggle of MainStreet.com. You know, I've seen friends and relatives go through divorces, and I've experienced one myself. So I know that if you're going through a divorce, your future financial well-being is often the last thing on your mind. And in your mentally anguished state of mind, emotions get in the way, and it's easier to make mistakes that can cost you in the years to come. Now, no one plans on getting a divorce, but with 40 to 50% of us doing so in the U.S., it behooves everyone, including happily married couples, to know how to be prepared for the eventuality of divorce. So here are three of the worst financial mistakes I want you to avoid during a divorce. Mistake number one, you lack an understanding of the household's finances or don't know where the assets are. You know, dividing assets should not be too difficult. It's actually pretty simple because alimony and child support are dictated in most states by a formula, and financial professionals view divorce purely as an economic divide. That part is pretty easy. It's a formula, 50-50 or whatever it may be, and there isn't a lot to talk about. But when one spouse doesn't have a clear understanding of the household or business assets, they have no basis to know what they're due. They are literally starting out at zero and taking wild guesses at what should come their way after a divorce. And these guesses are often either too high or too low. And with emotions and anger raging, it can get pretty crazy in the negotiating room. So it greatly helps to have an understanding of the assets you have accumulated through the period of your marriage and have a game plan for going into the negotiations. So, as a first step, make sure you get more involved in family finances or just look at all the accounts and get a better handle on things. If you were not involved earlier, you may have to hire what's called a forensic accountant who discovers all your spouse's assets, known and hidden, so you can get your fair share. Forensic accountants dig through everything, such as bank statements and IRAs. They go through the tax history. They ask questions and fill in the gaps. Think of them as private detectives for your family's finances. Even so, it can still be hard to find money your spouse may have deliberately hidden, so the best remedy is prevention. And you don't have to be an accountant to gain a decent understanding of your household's money. At the very least, know what's there at a high level, so discovery is easier down the road. And as clinical psychologist Barbara Greenberg says, it all comes down to this. You love your children more than you dislike your spouse, because you're not just going to be taking care of yourself, you're also going to be caring for your children, so you have to educate yourself. There's nothing beneficial about one spouse being rich and one being poor, she stresses, and you don't want to wake up one day and realize you should have done it differently. All right, mistake number two, you don't have a good financial advisor or legal team. Now, when you're going through the trauma of divorce, you lose your objectivity in decision-making and are typically a neophyte on what a divorce entails. So it helps to enlist the experts, a team that has experience at this and does this basically every day. And you want that team on your side so they can guide you through the process. Depending on the size of your assets, you could do fine with a small 3 or 4 person team and then just bring in the big guns if large amounts are at stake. But remember, divorce lawyers are often keen on maximizing their fees, so it helps greatly if you are rational, take the high road, make reasonable compromises, and get it over and done with. One final notion on the legal side, make sure you have your own representation. Don't use your spouse's people, even though they might make it sound as if you'll save a lot of money by doing so. Ethical lawyers will insist the other party has separate representation, but this is something you should insist upon too. Also, have a trusted financial advisor before and after the divorce is also very important. Unlike having separate lawyers, if you or your spouse use the same advisor, it's okay for both of you to continue a relationship with that advisor because there are no conflict of interest concerns. A financial advisor can legally give both spouses advice all the way through and can make sure all assets are explained and get both assets settled into a new financial plan with asset allocation based on their new situation. All right, mistake number 3. You agree to things or expect things that aren't written in the divorce decree. In a divorce, make sure you get everything that's of material consequence in writing. So many times people say they conceded to something because they believe the other person was acting in good faith like they themselves were. But if it isn't in writing, you could end up being the loser. With emotions that so often surround divorce, you can't count on the other person always acting rationally, so everything needs to be in writing, signed, and properly dated. So bear these 3 things in mind, especially point number 1 on understanding your joint finances right after you get married. And of course, I hope none of my married listeners ever have to face the agony of divorce, but I'm not unaware of marriage's harsh realities and would rather you be prepared for all eventualities, however unfortunate the thought. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.